Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Lindsay Whistle-Fenton. The opioid epidemic has been described as the worst public health crisis in Pennsylvania. Jason Snyder has both professional and personal experience with the battle against addiction. He is currently the Regional Director of Outpatient Services in Eastern Pennsylvania for Pinnacle Treatment Centers. Snyder previously served in the Wolf administration, where he oversaw the governor's Centers of Excellence. This interview is part of the statewide Battling Opioids project. Jason Snyder, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
There's obviously a lot of talk these days about the opioid epidemic, both in Pennsylvania and throughout the country. How has this epidemic impacted your family?
It's completely changed the course of what we would have expected, I think, as we were growing up. And when you look at where a family is supposed to go, so to speak, we ended up nowhere near that. So it has had an enormous impact on us.
Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood and your upbringing?
I am a lifelong Pennsylvanian, born and raised in Cambria County, the oldest of three boys, two parents who very soon, September 4th, will celebrate their 47th wedding anniversary.
Wow.
Together. So my mother was a stay-at-home mother. My dad, blue-collar, middle-income guy, worked for the electric company. He provided for us everything we needed, most things we wanted, coached our little league teams, took us on nice vacations as he could. We were raised in the church, a little church in small Portage, Pennsylvania, called Bethany United Methodist Church. My mother was very active in our schoolwork, probably our biggest fan when it came to those little league games, wrestling matches, football games. By all measures, I think you would call us a typical blue-collar Western Pennsylvania family, much like most families across the Commonwealth. Addiction was not something that we thought about. It wasn't something that we talked about. Of course, it was a much different time than today. Heroin was essentially unheard of in the circles we traveled and in rural Cambria County. Of course, you had your pretty standard underage drinking parties and the marijuana, things like that. And my brothers and I were right in the middle of that many times. But addiction, overdose, death from addiction was nothing that we thought about because, though we didn't say it, I believe the thought was it doesn't happen to families like ours.
Like yours.
If you go back to your first question, how has it impacted us? This was not supposed to be our story.
And when you say this, you mean addiction and
absolutely. So where does the impact of addiction come in? As we got older, we watched for many years as my brother Todd spiraled deeper into his addiction. We knew that Todd was in a bad place. We even knew in the back of our minds that death was a possibility. But I think we held on to this hope that he was going to pull out of this. It was a surreal time. It was a nightmare. We held on to this hope that we were going to wake up from this nightmare, but we never did. I remember vividly the morning of January 24th, 2005. I got a phone call from Todd's girlfriend, who he lived with at the time. We both lived in Pittsburgh. She said she couldn't get Todd up. I knew right away what was at issue. Told her to call 911, and I was there before the paramedics arrived. Evident to me that Todd was already dead. He lay on the floor. His color had begun to change. The paramedics arrived, ultimately pronounced him dead, and I made what to this day has been the worst phone call I've ever had to make, and that was to my parents. My dad answered the phone, and I told him that Todd had overdosed. And he asked whether he was okay, and I said no, and set off a chain reaction of wailing. First my dad, then my mother, who lay in bed with him. And lastly, I could hear my youngest brother, Josh, apparently come out of his bedroom and cry and wail at the news of the death of Todd. Todd was 28. dead of a heroin overdose. Todd was a college graduate with a degree in accounting, held some very good jobs in his brief professional life, including with Alcoa in Pittsburgh. Todd was a very smart guy, He left behind a daughter who was six at the time. And we were devastated by his death, even though we knew this was a possibility. Just don't think it's going to happen to you, just like you don't think addiction is going to happen to you. But when it happened again to us a little more than 2.5 years later, we were dismantled, is the best word I've found to describe us. The morning of September 14th, 2007, I got a phone call from my mother telling me that Josh, the brother who was wailing in the background at the news of Todd's death, Josh was dead of a drug overdose at age 25. Josh's son was born November 14, 2007, exactly 2 months after Josh's death, and so obviously he'll never know his father. And so we were dismantled. Here was a family raised as I described, given all of these opportunities with good parents, and now they have buried two of their three children.
I do think there is a kind of narrative that you can inoculate a family against the disease of addiction by providing a quote-unquote good family life.
I think absolutely strong families can go a long way to helping to prevent addiction. But in the time that I have done this work and in the interactions I've had with families and the people I've met along this path, stories like mine are commonplace. Of course, many people end up addicted who have underlying traumatic issues, childhood trauma. There are certainly a percentage of people struggling with the disease of addiction today who were not as fortunate as I was. So I think what that demonstrates is, as we continue to say, the disease of addiction knows no boundaries, rich, poor, good families, broken families, however you want to describe them. It really cuts across all demographics. And so with my brother's deaths, I was the last man standing, so to speak, the last living child of my parents, which made it all the more difficult for me in late 2011 to tell them that I was addicted to opioids. Prescription pain medication, oxycodone and oxymorphone were the drugs that I was addicted to, though I had used and abused drugs and alcohol for more than 20 years leading up to this point of addiction. I've come to know that addiction is a progressive disease. Some progress much more quickly than others. Mine was, as I've called it, a slow burn. But ultimately, it was the prescription pain medication that drove me to treatment. It was then that I told my parents that I was entering treatment. And I can only imagine how much fear that sent through them. Of course, I could see it in their face and in their reaction. And oftentimes, those who are in the grips of active addiction, like I was, believe that they're fooling people. But it was also evident when I told my parents that they knew something was wrong. Obviously, unfortunately, for me, my path has been so far much different than my brother's. Today, I identify as a person in long-term recovery from the disease of addiction, which for me means I've not had a drink or drug in a little more than 6.5 years. And the difference between today and 7 years ago is night and day. It's 180 degrees from where it once was.
You said that people in active addiction think they're fooling people. What did your life look like to people on the outside? Would anybody have any clue that you were struggling with addiction?
So what I thought my life looked like, and I think I did a pretty good job of it, although, you know, again, perception and perspective is very distorted at those times. I was a professional. I was a college, am a college graduate. At the time I went into treatment, I held the title of senior vice president for a small public relations company. I was married at the time. You know, we owned a home, two cars in the driveway, summertime, go on a nice vacation, try to present myself, you know, as if I had everything together. But I really believe that my life was a house of cards at the time. It was just, at any minute, it was going to collapse. It took everything I could, everything I had to keep this this facade up. It was a daily struggle. My life behind that facade was unmanageable. It was really a matter of finding ways and means to get more. I was not being prescribed the pills. I was actively seeking them out, either from connections, others who were getting them legitimately, that kind of thing. And so it was a constant hustle to sustain that addiction. So one of the biggest things that I look back on and my reluctance to ask for help, and the reason why I waited so long, was because I believed that people thought I was something. I told myself I was something. I had had success. I had success, so there was no way that I was going to put my hand up at the time and say I'm addicted. The stigma that surrounds the disease of addiction is such that I did not want to be affiliated with people who were addicted. I did not want to be looked at the same way I believed my brothers were looked at. And so I continued to tell myself, this will be the last one, this will be the last time. I can't tell you how many times I hashed out these plans that would make it all right, and it never did, it never came to fruition.
What finally drove you to seek treatment?
There, before I went to treatment the last couple of months, the marriage that I mentioned, which is no longer in existence in large part because of the things I did as part of my active addiction, those months before I went to treatment became desperate times. I knew my marriage was suffering. And in the grips of this act of addiction, in a hopeless time, I could not imagine how I would survive if my marriage ended. And so I think in a half-hearted attempt to say, look, I'm going to try something, I went to some 12-step recovery meetings and continued to use, even as I went to these meetings. But I am a huge proponent today of 12-step recovery. It is through those meetings and through the people that I met at those meetings that I finally had enough clarity of thought and had heard enough suggestions and believed what people were telling me that I ended up in treatment. So it was an attempt, again, a kind of a half-hearted attempt to say, look, I'm going to try to do something about this, which really turned into a sincere effort based on the people I met and the things I heard at these 12-step meetings.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Lindsay Whistle-Fenton, and our guest is Jason Snyder, Director of Outpatient Services in Eastern Pennsylvania for Pinnacle Treatment Centers. He has been in recovery for more than 6 years. You mentioned the stigma and what a challenge that was for you to even come forward and seek treatment. How did you overcome that fear of stigma to the point that you are today openly sharing your story with others?
It took a little bit of time. Certainly isn't something that I was comfortable doing in what we call early recovery, and really wouldn't be advised, I don't think, either, because it's such a tenuous time, early recovery, and for many, many people, relapse is part of that recovery process. And so once I had a few years under my belt, in my perspective on things changes, and what was important to you before is maybe not as important as it is now, and you seek ways to serve others or to help in any way you can, I thought, well, this is the way I can help. This is the way I can help to destigmatize the disease by presenting a more accurate picture of what the person with the disease of addiction looks like. Before I came to understand the disease, and before I came to 12-step recovery, and before I came to the world of treatment, in my mind, the person with an addiction was a criminal, was someone who injected or shot up in an alley behind a dumpster. It was all of these stereotypical images that we often see. And of course, there is a percentage of those who are addicted who fit that bill. It's just where folks end up. But there's also a large percentage of people who look like me and you, and who are in the same desperate situation as those other folks I described. So I wanted people to see that those folks you call junkies and those folks who you don't think are worth helping, they are your children. They are your children's friends. This is not what you believe it to be. This affects everyone. And so that was my thinking. Additionally, my family story is a powerful one. And if we can use Todd and Josh's stories as a way to help others, either let other families know that, hey, you're not alone, because this is an isolating disease. My mother, I know to this day, is still filled with shame and guilt, and it isolates people. And so if through our shared experience I can let someone know that you're not alone, this isn't your fault, and we understand, then my brother's lives will have had greater purpose. If we can prevent somebody from using, or we can get somebody to go to treatment because of their stories, then we will have memorialized them in a way that their lives need not have been in vain.
What don't people understand if they haven't had any personal experience with addiction, or maybe a family member with addiction? What misinformation would you like to correct?
I think people who don't have any direct experience with it wonder, why can't you just stop? Can't you see all the damage you're creating, the damage you're doing to yourself, to those around you? Nobody chooses to become addicted. Now, of course, we all make the choice to put that first chemical in us. There's no question that we make that choice, but no one who I know has done that with the goal of getting addicted in mind. What happens is, at least in my experience, you continue to progress, don't realize how far down this path you've gotten, and one day you realize, I am addicted and I can't stop. I want to stop, but all my mind thinks about is using. It no longer becomes about feeling good. It becomes about feeling, quote unquote, normal. Without the drugs, especially the opioids, the withdrawal, the despair, the hopelessness, the lack of motivation, really the inability to function on any level is so great, and the answer is so simple. Use again. The mind is constantly obsessed with feeding that addiction. the brain chemistry has been changed. And so to answer your short question with a long answer, I think the biggest misconception is that you can simply choose to walk away from an opioid addiction if you really wanted to. Now, are there some people who have? I'm sure there are. But for the vast majority of people, it's not that simple. It requires intensive treatment. More and more we've come to know that treatment needs to be assisted by medications because of the changes to the brain. So the biggest misconception is that you can simply stop anytime you choose.
While with the Wolf administration, you oversaw the governor's Centers of Excellence, which focus on treating underlying mental and physical health issues in addition to treating substance use disorder. Why is it important to focus on the whole person when treating the disease of addiction?
When we treat addiction in isolation and don't address the underlying physical and or mental health issues that may have led to the addiction, then we're not going to have a lot of success in treating just that addiction. I often share a story of a young woman I came to know through 12-step recovery. Haven't seen her for a couple of years. But at the time, she had just turned 21, and she had been at that point through 8 residential treatment stays, and she was still an IV heroin user. And I think the layperson looks at that and says, wow, 8 times through residential treatment, and you're still shooting heroin. Well, as I come to find out about this young woman, her father sexually molested her as a child. Mother was actively addicted to alcohol, and she began to use heroin at age 13. And so when you consider the underlying trauma that this young woman was dealing with, and you don't address it, you simply address the addiction, it's no wonder that in very short order after those residential stays, as a coping mechanism for trauma that I can't even begin to imagine, she turns back to the one thing that takes her away from that, that helps her not think about or feel that. And so the same holds true with chronic pain, chronic back pain, for example. We know the story. Overprescribing of opioids has led to this epidemic. So for those folks who came to this legitimately doing what the doctor prescribed, if we now try to take them off of, if they've progressed to heroin, off of the heroin, but we don't address the pain, we're not going to have a lot of success. So really treating the whole person, integrating physical, mental health care with addiction is really the direction I think the treatment world is going.
Estimates are that as many as 90% of people who need treatment for addiction don't receive it. What do we need to change in order to make sure that more people are getting the help that they need?
So it's interesting. Who need it don't get it. We don't say who want it don't get it. So there's 9 out of every 10 who needs it, but they're afraid to put their hand up, because when you look at what the vocal minority says about those with the disease of addiction, you look at any online story about this and you read the comments and people say, let them die. This is God's way of taking out the trash. Who wants to put their hand up in an environment like that and say, I'm addicted, I need help? So I think the biggest thing that we can do is to educate ourselves and understand that this is a disease, work to destigmatize it. One of the best ways to do that is for those who have achieved recovery to step forward and share their stories, although even that is a conundrum because many folks haven't been given the wonderful opportunity that I have, and fear of retribution exists. So if we can relax that stigma, help people understand that this is a disease, I think we'll go a long way toward helping more people get into treatment.
Defining success can be tricky when talking about what a successful recovery looks like. How do you personally define a successful recovery?
That's a great question, and I think it's individual. For me, my recovery, as I mentioned earlier, certainly starts with the abstinence from alcohol and drugs, narcotics. That's the foundation. That's the base. But it's also really a matter of trying to live a better life, a principled life, understanding that my perspective is sometimes off, that my perception is sometimes off, that the way I encounter the world or the way I deal with particular issues sometimes isn't the most effective or the best way to do this. And so oftentimes you'll hear people say the only thing you need to change as part of your recovery is everything. So we realize that the use of the drugs is almost a symptom of the disease. There's a great mental component to it. And so for me, recovery is also making better decisions. It's choosing to be grateful rather than looking at those things that I might consider to be less than ideal. It's acceptance. It's responsibility. All of those things slide right out the door for many of us in active addiction. And so it's really about, for me today, of course, first and foremost, it has to be about not using drugs. But the greater challenge for me and really the path that I'm on is, how do I become a better person? How do I make better decisions? How do I live a life of gratitude? How do I choose to be positive rather than negative? Because all of those things, negativity, woe is me attitude, pretty soon can make using drugs look attractive again. So that's how I define recovery. For some others, recovery is no longer putting a needle in their arm. And for those folks who may still be able to have a drink, I'm not going to sit here and condemn, criticize, or judge their recovery. For some people, stopping stealing to support an IV heroin habit and stopping the actual act of using that drug, for them, that is recovery. And so, again, I would say it's an individualized answer.
What message would you give to someone who's listening who might be struggling and thinking about seeking treatment but holding off because they're afraid?
I would say that there's no question that if you continue down the path you're on now, things are not going to get better. They're in all likelihood going to get worse. You have nothing really to lose when you reach a particular point in your addiction. You have nothing to lose and everything to gain. If you seek help, things can only get better.
Jason Snyder, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. It was my pleasure.
Jason Snyder is the Director of Outpatient Services in Eastern Pennsylvania for Pinnacle Treatment Centers. He has been in recovery for more than 6 years. This story is part of Battling Opioids, a Pennsylvania public media collaboration focused on the opioid crisis. Hear more Take Note interviews on our website at wpsu.org/take note. I'm Lindsay Whistle Fenton, WPSU.